Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Try and Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, it's my pleasure to come to you live from our studios at Prashanti Nilayam. This is the program where we go through the beautiful work of the Bhagavad Gita, and we are in the fourth chapter. The last time around, we covered four verses, and I think, as always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we covered in that episode. We covered the verses 25, 26, 27, and 28. But before coming to those verses, in verse number 23, Krishna had said that a jnani performs all actions as a yajna and thereby gets rid of all the karmas. And then he goes on to explain how for jnani everything is Brahman, which is the Brahmarpanam shloka. Then from the 25th verse, which we covered last time, Krishna speaks about the various types of yogis. They may or may not be jnanis, and I think that's an important point. They perform different kinds of sadhanas to get to the point where they acquire that knowledge. But then he explains how everything that they perform, every kind of sadhana which is performed, is in fact a kind of a yajna. So in the 25th verse, Krishna first refers to the regular concept of yajna, where he says that some people very sincerely perform this ritualistic fire sacrifice to please different gods and devatas. And I think that's how yajnas are meant to be, as given in the Vedas or the Karma Kanda of the Vedas. That there are different yajnas which are performed for different purposes. In fact, yajnas are themselves sometimes referred to as kamya karmas. You have a certain desire that you want to achieve and you perform yajnas as a karma which will get you that desire. So we saw how this is the regular way ritualistic people do this yajna. And so Krishna says, when even this kind of a yajna, when it is done sincerely, even though it is being offered to a deity or one particular devata or a form of God, when it is done sincerely, even this process purifies the mind of the person. In the very next line of that same shloka, Krishna says that some yogis offer yajnas to yajna. And this is a very cryptic statement, and I had offered two interpretations for this. Yajna is also another name for God. So considering it that way, the interpretation would be that it becomes a contrast to what was said in the previous statement. In the previous line, it was said that some people perform yajnas and offer it to devatas. But if you say yajna also refers to the supreme, all-pervasive divinity, then he's contrasting that with saying that some sadhakas perform yajna, making an offering to the Supreme Lord himself. Another way of looking at that same statement is, some people give up yajna as a yajna, which means some people give up the act of performing yajnas itself. And this statement then could be seen as a description of a sannyasi who gives up the prescribed rituals and becomes a renunciant. Because this again has this historical perspective where every householder was supposed to perform these yajnas as part of their duties, and a sannyasi invariably gives up some of these prescribed yajnas, which depend on which family that person comes from, which lineage that person comes from, and so on and so forth. So giving up yajnas itself as a yajna could well be a description of a sannyasi. So I said both of these suggest that there are different kinds of sadhanas that can be performed, and all of these equally purify the mind. In the 26th verse, Krishna speaks about a couple of other yogis. One who offers the indriyas or the senses in the fire of samyama or self-restraint, and some other yogis who offer the sense objects in the fire of the senses. And we discussed how these two statements are the dual disciplines of Shama and Dama, very popularly spoken of in the Brahma Sutras, which again is one of the Prasthanatrayas. So the second line refers to a certain self-restraint that comes when one consumes through the senses with the feeling that the Lord seated within is the consumer, and the senses are the fire through which I reach my offerings to the Lord within. And the sense objects, the shabda, rupa, sparsha, the form, the smells, the sounds, all of these are the ahuti that I offer. So the simple act of seeing, hearing, and going through life through perceiving the world through our senses becomes an act of a yajna. So automatically there'll be a certain amount of self-restraint, and we spoke about how when we lead life with this attitude, automatically we start wondering, is this suitable for me to consume, because the Lord within is accepting this as an offering. The first statement, as I said, is referred to as shama or mind control, where the mind is completely turned inward, by which means the senses do not interact with the sense objects at all. And understandably, it is a higher level than what we refer to as dhamma, because dhamma is more of simple sense control, but shama is one step higher, which is a form of mind control itself. And the scriptures say that dhamma is something that will lead you to shama eventually. The 27th verse speaks specifically about recluses or renunciants or sannyasis, one who has offered all his actions and sense organs and desires in the fire of Atma Samyama Yoga. And I mentioned that Atma Samyama Yoga is going to be a completely different chapter altogether. There's going to be extensive discourse on that. So we'll come to that. But the verse 27 is a description of a sannyasi, because clearly Krishna says all actions, sarvani karmani, he says all actions, sarvani indriyani, all sensual desires, actions, cravings, everything is offered in this fire of Atma Samyama Yoga. In the 28th verse, the fourth verse that we covered last time, Krishna very quickly lists out a host of other sadhakas who come under this list of people who perform yajnas. He says that those who perform charity, he calls it dravya yajna, those who perform swadhyaya. Swadhyaya is a form of studying the scriptures. It's a discipline of studying the scriptures. It is also a discipline of chanting Vedas regularly on a daily basis. So Krishna says some people perform the yajna of swadhyaya. And he says then there are people who live a very austere life, and that is the yajna they perform. And some people live a very regulated life for when they take up a vow, or what we refer to as a diksha. Right? For a limited period, they follow certain very, very rigid disciplines. So Krishna says that all of these people are sadhakas and all of these people are performers of yajnas. So a lot of spiritual and mundane activities, as we can see, are covered in the process. The condition, of course, is one must have a higher goal in mind, and one must do all such actions consciously as a form of worship. And when that is done, almost you can see the whole gamut of sadhana, the whole gamut of even decent living, as we're going to see towards the end of today's show. I think in one of the shlokas we'll see even normal regulated living can be described as a yajna, and that process will lead to antakarna shuddhi or purification of the mind, and it prepares you to become a jnani. So Krishna is going to mention a few more such yogas and yogis in the next few shlokas. A couple of very, very interesting ones are there. So we'll go into those shlokas. We'll go into shloka number 29 right away. As always, I have it in the voice of Brother Shyam, who's beautifully rendered it for us. We'll listen to shloka number 29. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we'll discuss in detail.
Apane juhvati pranam prane panam tatha pare pranapana gati rudhva pranayama parayana.
Others who are committed to the practice of pranayama offer as sacrifice the outgoing breath in the incoming and the incoming in the outgoing, restraining the cause of the outgoing and the incoming breaths. This is the meaning of shloka number 21, and I feel this particular shloka is one of the many very cryptic shlokas of the Bhagavad Gita. and as I've mentioned a few times before, one is the context of the message that Krishna is delivering. Krishna is speaking about the importance of karma and how karma prepares the mind for jnana. And we will see that Krishna will summarize this entire section with that reiteration shortly when we come to that shloka. So in that context, this is a very simple extension of the examples that we've been coming across so far and what Krishna has been giving. Pranayama yoga is also one of the forms of yajna, and he says that how that is also just another form of or another method to purify the mind. So the continuous theme is to turn Arjuna's attention to a spiritual goal and explain to him that to reach the spiritual goal, he must continue to do the duty that lies before him, but with a slight change in the mental approach. Right? So that is the context of this entire discourse. And the specific context of this portion is Krishna trying to tell Arjuna that all of these are forms of sadhana, all of these are forms of yajna. You do not have to think that being a warrior is not being spiritual and being a sannyasi is being more spiritual or becoming a mendicant is more spiritual. Right? So that is the context in which the shloka, of course, explained. This becomes one more example of people who specifically perform pranayama as a form of yoga. But also, if you look at Gita as a text itself, Gita touches upon many of the very valid practices and concepts from Vedas and Upanishads. In a way, these are all practices that are relevant even today, right? That is why Gita makes a reference of the many, many which are there in the scriptures. Some specific practices are made references to. I think it is in a way of showing us that these practices are still valid even for this age, and we will all benefit if we practice them. For instance, there are shlokas that have very, very relevant interpretations of Ayurveda itself. In fact, we had a couple of shows in which I think Brother Bishu had spoken to a doctor who's done extensive research in Ayurveda, and he was referring to some of the shlokas in the Gita and saying how these can be directly used in the science of Ayurveda, right? Similarly, some shlokas speak of some very complex concepts in Advaita, which is very cryptically mentioned in the Upanishads, but Krishna elaborates it here. We also come across some shlokas that have a very historic relevance. A couple of episodes back, we spoke about the debate between Purva and Uttara Mimamsa. That is touched upon slightly in the Bhagavad Gita. So in that sense, like many other shlokas in the Gita, I think this shloka too has been interpreted in many ways, because it has many such relevance in the way I just explained right now. This particular shloka, and of course the next shloka, is also spoken of as one of the highest forms of yogic practice in some of the interpretations that have been given. But some say it is a very simple pranayama referred to by Patanjali. That is one more interpretation. Some in fact speak of it as a very profound explanation of the pranayama forms that are practiced as part of Hatha Yoga. As I said, some people study this from the angle of Ayurveda. I guess all of these interpretations certainly cannot be covered during our program. It is certainly outside the scope of this program, and also I should confess that it is beyond my abilities too. I just made a mention of all of these various interpretations that are out there, because if anyone is interested, I think they will find the study of this particular shloka very fascinating, because it appears like a very simple shloka, but it has got layers and layers of meaning. For our understanding, we'll probably confine ourselves to the references of pranayama that is given in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. The simple reason being, in Swami's discourses, Swami has spoken extensively about this simple form of pranayama, and we will find that it also, you know, doesn't complicate it too much when we are trying to interpret this particular shloka. So let us go back to the shloka wherein the continuation of the examples are being given by Krishna. And Krishna now gives the example of one set of yogis whom Krishna refers to as pranayama parayanaha. Parayana means to make something one's chief focus. You give your full attention to one particular activity. That is referred to as Parayana. We call it Veda Parayana, for instance, when people sit and study or chant Vedas. Sometimes the satsangs that we have in the hostel when we used to sit late in the night and one of the elderly senior teachers would speak to us about Swami, we would refer to that as a Parayanam. Because any act by which you try to focus on one particular activity is referred to as a Parayana. So here he is saying Parayanaha. People who focus on one particular activity and they have taken up Pranayama as their focus. So they are referred to by this noun Pranayama Parayanaha. We might wonder what is so great about this Parayanam that somebody can focus on it and take it up as a yogic practice itself and do it as a sadhana completely. There are many types of pranayama. Some are so advanced and their benefits are absolutely immense and deep that people who concentrate on this, there is no end to how much one can achieve, right? From a simple thing of having a very, very healthy life with disease-free life till very late and advanced age to something like levitating. All of this can be achieved through the simple practices of the various types of pranayama. That's why when Krishna says pranayama parayanaha, it's a huge sect of sadhakas who purely, you know, gain mastery over their mind and body through the act of different types of parayana. In fact, there's a very beautiful excerpt from Swami's Vidyavahini, and I thought I should make a mention of this because it's a very, very practical thing. It is very useful for you and me. I'm not sure how many of us want to levitate, right? But this particular aspect that Swami is speaking about is very useful for you and me, and I thought we should make a mention of this. So this is in Swami's Vidyavahini, one of Swami's Vahinis, and I happened to come across this where Swami speaks about a very specific purpose for pranayama, and the pranayama Swami is referring to is very simple pranayama. So Swami says that the mind has two functions, thinking, which is alochana, and inner dialogue, which is manasika sambhashana. So these are the two activities the mind is always engaged in, alochana or thinking, and manasika sambhashana or inner dialogue. Swami goes on to say that thinking is a process by which we find solutions to our problems. We find ways of getting work done and so on. But this mental chatter, manasika sambhashana, Swami says, tends to escalate problems. It creates more confusion. It creates fear. It creates fear and takes away peace of mind. Swami goes on to explain how it continues all through our waking hours because it does not require any physical activity. It goes on in the mind. So even when you're doing something else, when you're busy with something else, there is a possibility of this internal mental chatter continuing. So Swami says it continues as long as you're awake. And when you sleep, it continues in the dream. It even leads to a fall in your health and it leads to faster aging, right? These are all Swami's words. And invariably, Swami says that this mental chatter is about the flaws that are in others and things that may not necessarily be relevant to us at this point in time. And the end result of all this is we lose mind space and it becomes a huge obstacle in the spiritual journey, apart from ruining our regular life itself. Right? So Swami emphasizes so much on this. And it is so true. I mean, you just have to observe yourself, observe your own mental chatter. You will find that, yes, some things are related to the problems that we have or the people who trouble us. But you will find an enormous amount of the mental chatter is absolutely irrelevant. We are imagining things. We are creating conversations in our mind. We are thinking that somebody is going to behave with us in a certain manner. We think that somebody will always react in a certain manner. So much of imagination and we start spinning our own stories in our mind. It's so true what Swami says and so clearly Swami says it will lead to lack of peace of mind, it will lead to ill health and it will lead to faster aging also. So those of us who are interested in staying young for as long as we wish to, Swami says we have to cut down this mental chatter. Then Swami goes on to say that the Upanishads have given us a few sadhanas to deal with this mental chatter, and one of them is the practice of pranayama. Of course, when Swami goes on to explain that the act of seva, the act of japam and dhyana, and Swami also says listening to spiritual discourses and performing mananam. If you look at mananam, mananam is also a certain form of internal contemplation or internal mental chatter. But then you take spiritual thoughts, you take positive thoughts, and then when you do mananam on that, this is a way by which you are giving the mind something to munch, right? The mind wants to keep thinking of something, the mind wants to chatter with itself, but then you give it positive thoughts to chatter about, right? So that is Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam that Swami speaks about. That's a different topic altogether, but the most important point is, the point that I wanted to highlight is, Swami mentioning how this simple practice of pranayama quietens the mind and it prepares us for the higher goal. Precisely what Krishna has been speaking about in this particular portion of the fourth chapter. Because all of these yajnas he is referring to are means to antakaran shuddhi, inner purity. Swami says in this chapter in Vidyavahini that this regulation of breath is not some extremely difficult gymnastics or a very formidable exercise. The mind simply has to concentrate on the period of retention of the breath, which is referred to as kumbhaka, on the process of inhaling, which is called puraka, and the process of exhaling that breath, which is rechaka. So when attention is fixed on these three processes, Swami says that the inner talk on other irrelevant matters will slowly subside, and mental strength will be acquired in this process. So Swami says it seems like a very simple exercise of just observing your breath, but it is very effective. So what looks like a very simple exercise of simply inhaling and holding the breath and exhaling puraka, kumbhaka and rechaka is a very effective method to control and silence the mind. And this is coming from Swami himself. So it's a beautiful tool and beautiful tip that Swami is giving. I just came across this when I was preparing for this program. So I thought it's a very important thing that Swami is saying. Such a simple technique that Swami has given. Right? Because I often find this, that Swami speaks a lot of things. Much of it is for internal contemplation. There are very, very few things that can be practically practiced. Like, for instance, why is bhajans and seva so popular among Swami's devotees or among sadhakas? Because that is something that can be done, right? Or namasmarana for that matter. So anything that can be taken and done, which will lead to some kind of an internal improvement, is, I think, always welcome. So in that sense, Swami is saying that this mental chatter can be controlled by performing pranayama. The word pranayama is made of two words, prana and ayama. Ayama means to extend or restrain, and prana is the life force in the body. And I'm sure most of our listeners will be familiar with what is referred to as the pancha pranas, or the five life forces in the body: prana, apana, vyana, udana and samana. Of these five, the first one, which is simply called prana, the other ones are called apana prana, vyana prana, udana prana, samana prana. The first one is called prana prana, right? Or simply prana. The first prana is associated with the breathing process. That is why basic pranayama is nothing more than simple conscious breathing exercise. And one of the most popular forms of pranayama is referred to as Anulom Vilom Pranayama. I'm sure many of our listeners and Swami's devotees do practice this on a daily basis, where we close one nostril, inhale through the other nostril, retain our breath for a few seconds, and then exhale through the other nostril. We'll come back to this process. This is also one of the techniques that Swami himself has spoken about in his discourses. There are different types of pranayamas, but this is one pranayama that Swami himself has spoken about. In fact, if I am not wrong, during 1993 summer course, in one of the discourses when Swami was speaking about this, Swami himself demonstrated the Anulom Vilom Pranayama to the students who were gathered there, right? So it's a very, it's a technique which has, if I could say, the blessing of Swami. So Swami says there are other types of pranayama which are very complicated, which should not be taken up without the guidance of a guru. But this one is very simple, and Swami has himself demonstrated it. So for our listeners who would like to pick it up, this probably is one of the good techniques to pick up. So prana in general means the life force associated with the breathing process. But more specifically, prana is also the exhaling step within the process of breathing. And the act of inhaling is referred to as apana. Because to be able to draw air within the body, we need the apana prana. The apana prana is that vital air which pushes air downwards, right? So for inhaling, you need apana prana. And for exhaling, Swami says, the scriptures say that you need prana. So as a noun, prana and apana are two of the five panchapranas. But as a verb, if you look at it, apana is inhaling and prana is exhaling. So apana is synonymous with puraka and prana is synonymous with rechaka or exhaling. And kumbhaka, as I said, is the period where we retain the breath. And Swami explains clearly when speaking about this Anulom Vilom Pranayama. Of course, Swami doesn't use that phrase Anulom Vilom. Swami just calls it Pranayama. That the time that we take to inhale should be exactly same as the amount of time we retain the breath and the amount of time that we take to exhale what we have breathed in. And we are supposed to do this consciously and slowly increasing the duration of these three processes. That is the meaning of pranayama, extending this breathing process slowly, right? Swami would say that the more breaths that a being takes, the number of times one inhales and exhales within a minute will actually decide the lifespan of that particular being. And Swami would often give the example of a dog, which has this very, very fast inhaling and exhaling process, and we know that a dog's lifespan is much lower, right? So Swami would say, even as human beings, if we are able to extend this inhaling and exhaling process, this puraka, kumbhaka and rechaka can be extended, it will lead to extension of one's lifespan. So there are yogis who have mastered this pranayama to such an extent that a single puraka, kumbhaka and rechaka cycle would be performed for even hours and sometimes even days, right? And that is how they could live for hundreds of years, right? This is something which Swami would say. And this process also calms the mind so much so that eventually in this moment of kumbhaka, when the breath is retained, they actually are able to hit samadhi, right? So it seems like a very simple process, but when done with that intent, and that's why I think probably Krishna is making a special reference to pranayama parayanaha, the people who take up this as a sadhana in itself. So let us come back to our shloka here. Remember, Krishna is going to describe the sadhana of pranayama also as a yajna. That is the background. So he says, apane juhvati prana. In apana or inhalation, prana or exhalation is sacrificed. Prane apanam. And in exhalation, inhalation is sacrificed. I'll repeat it again. Apane juhvati prana. In inhalation, exhalation is sacrificed. Prane apanam. And in exhalation, inhalation is sacrificed. Now, what is the simplest meaning of this, or simplest interpretation of this? When I'm inhaling, I can't exhale. So to inhale, I must for that time period give up exhalation. Similarly, when I'm exhaling, I must stop inhaling. So in that sense, I sacrifice prana in apana and apana in prana. In the very next line he says, prana apana gati rudhva. Prana apana gati means the movement of the inward and the outward flowing air, or stopping the inhalation and exhalation, which is what we refer to as the third step in pranayama, which is kumbhaka. So prana apana gati rudhva means stopping this movement of inhalation and exhalation, which is the reference to the process of kumbhaka. The word kumbhaka itself is very interesting. It comes from the root word kumbha. Kumbha means a pot or a vessel where you retain something. And when we perform kumbhaka, the lungs become like a pot. It holds or retains the breath that has been inhaled. Right? That's why the retaining step is called kumbhaka. So this is a general process of breathing. If you look at it, inhaling, just holding your breath, and then exhaling. Very similar to the other activities that Krishna gave as examples for a yajna. Simple control of the mind, simple control of the senses, simple charity, which even most of the worldly people do. Similarly, this inhalation and exhalation is done by everyone. But in a way, this retention or kumbhaka is what makes this difference, because when we very normally breathe and exhale, we are not going to be holding our breath behind. Right? So this kumbhaka is the process which kind of makes this slightly different from regular or normal breathing that we do. And you cannot maintain the same time if you don't do this consciously. Right? The whole idea of this particular pranayama is, Swami says, the amount of time that you take to inhale should be the same amount of time that you retain that breath, and the same amount of time that you exhale. So Swami says that you cannot do this unless you are consciously doing it, unless you are probably counting or you have a timer, right? So if you do not do it consciously, you cannot do it as a pranayama. It becomes a regular breathing process. Of course, Swami goes on to say that with practice, one masters this technique and one is able to do this without, you know, concentrating the mind. And that is when Swami says that you don't even have to use your fingers to close one nostril and open the other nostril. Automatically you will find that you are able to breathe in through one nostril and exhale through the other nostril, right? So Swami says these are all advanced processes. But to start with, Swami says you will have to keep a count mentally, which means this breathing process becomes a conscious exercise. And that is what is referred to as pranayama parayana. Simple breathing cannot become pranayama parayana. But when you look at it as a sadhana, then it becomes a yajna that leads to antakarana shuddhi. So in the context of the discourse of the Gita, this is just another example of a simple act that becomes a sadhana when performed consciously as a yajna. But it is one very important spiritual practice, right? So I think apart from just being an example, Krishna also touches upon some of these important techniques that are out there in our scriptures, which are relevant even today in our spiritual sadhana. In fact, when we had spoken to Mr. Raja Reddy, who lived with Swami for many, many years, I think over 20 years, a great bhajan singer, a great devotee who had the opportunity to serve Swami physically for so many years. But apart from all of this, he was a very, very great sadhaka who would never miss his meditation sessions and never miss his yoga and pranayama. And when we were speaking to him, he said that he spends a lot of time doing this pranayama. Almost more than an hour every day he performs only simple pranayama, because it's an extremely simple tool which has such profound benefits. And that's why I thought, though this is just another example, I thought it is worthwhile to spend a little more time on this. So this simple Anulom Vilom Pranayama, Swami says, has the ability to quieten the mind, strengthen the mind, and prepare the mind for higher goals in life. So that is the 29th verse where Krishna gives the example of one set of yogis who concentrate on pranayama. We'll go to the next verse, where again, few more examples are coming in the same context of yajna. So this is verse number 30. We'll listen to it. And after giving a brief meaning, we'll discuss in detail about it.
Apare niyatahara pranan praneshu juhvati sarvepyete yajna vido yajna kshapita kalmasha.
Others, having their food regulated, offer the vital forces in the vital forces. All of them are practitioners of yajna and people who have their impurities destroyed by yajna. Again, a shloka that has many, many interpretations, as I mentioned. Many of them are very valid and applicable to different kind of yogic approaches. And I think that's why it's not really worthwhile going into them unless one is very seriously taking up these practices. But we will try to go through a few of them, which probably gives us a more realistic understanding. This is the explanation that I'm giving are not the only way to explain this particular shloka, but something which we can relate to and something which we can understand, right? Now, after speaking about pranayama parayanaha, Krishna speaks about another set of yogis. He says, apare, others, are niyata aharaha. Ahara means food. Niyata means prescribed or regulated. So, niyata ahara means prescribed amounts of food or regulated food habits. Niyata aharaha means those that follow strictly these kind of prescribed rules and regulations with regard to food intake. We've often heard Swami say this in his discourses. In fact, so many times Swami has mentioned this. Swami would say that if you eat three times a day, you're a rogi, meaning that it'll lead to disease. If you eat twice a day, you're a bhogi, which means you're a regular person, worldly person. If you eat once a day, you are a yogi. So many sadhakas follow this very, very strictly, that they eat just about enough to keep the body healthy and alive. They don't cater to the cravings of the body and the cravings of the tongue. So such people don't eat for pleasure, right? So Swami would often make this other statement in his discourses again. Many, many times he has repeated this. Swami would say, hunger is a disease and food is the medicine. Thirst is a disease and water is the medicine. And Swami goes on to say that we must consume food with such an attitude. So a niyata ahara is one who is conscious about what he or she eats and how much is eaten. And as we have seen the pattern, any simple task when done consciously, deliberately, with regulation and with a higher purpose in mind, it becomes a form of upasana, it becomes a form of yajna. As I mentioned a while ago, there are five pranas which govern the body and our life in general, especially our physical body and of course even to a certain extent our mind and our spiritual journey too. Breathing involves a certain prana. Swallowing involves a specific prana. Digestion involves a prana. Excretion involves a prana. The spreading of nutrition involves a certain prana and so on. So the functions are divided among these five pranas. Now, when I perform this simple act of eating as a worship or a yajna, I offer the act of eating into the process of digestion. The digestion is offered then into the process of distribution. Then the remaining, which is unwanted, is then pushed out, right? So this whole process can be spoken of as one prana being offered into another prana as a yajna, isn't it? Just like the breathing process was described as apane juhvati prana, apane juhvati prana, prane apanam. Apana is offered in prana and prana into apana. The process of eating, digesting and excreting can also be spoken of as one prana. That is, the first prana being offered into samana, which is, takes care of digestion. Samana being offered into Vyana. The Vyana takes care of distribution of nutrition. And then the remaining food is offered to Apana to be expelled from the body, because Apana takes care of excretion. Of course, I'm just giving you an idea. A simple act like digestion involves more than just one prana, but I'm just giving you an idea of how different pranas are involved, and it's almost like something like a relay race. One does its task and passes on to the other, or something like you're having a lineup where one task is finished and the other set of people take over the task. Now, going back to what Krishna says in this verse, what exactly he says is, pranan praneshu juhvati. Prana is offered into prana. There is another very significant way of looking at this particular statement. I will not go too much into that detail. Many advanced techniques of yoga can be defined through this one statement. Swami would say how many yogis can live without food for many, many years. Just through breathing, they draw all the nourishment from the world just through breathing, and then they sustain themselves. Now, this act can also be spoken of as sacrificing one prana in another. Eating can be spoken of one prana being sacrificed into the other. But even this act of choosing only one prana to draw all your nourishment can also be spoken of as sacrificing one prana into the other, right? That is one of the ways of looking at it. I'm saying, so that's a little advanced thing. It's not probably relevant to us, so we'll not go much into the detail. But another beautiful interpretation of this prana being offered into prana is, for us to perform any vigorous activity, like say jumping up or lifting something big, or an example that the Upanishads give, that is pulling the string of a bow in order to shoot an arrow. If you look at all of these, the prana involved in such activities is referred to as Vyana prana. The Vyana prana is supposed to be the prana which is governing all the energy centers and the nerve centers in the body, right? And if you look at, observe all of these activities, intense activities, jumping, lifting something, or you know, doing something which calls for a lot of attention. If you look at it, we would either be holding our breath, or we will be partially regulating our breath when we are doing such activities. So that is described as offering prana apana in Vyana. Other way of explaining, pranan praneshu juhvati. When you are trying to perform something, you regulate your breathing and the Vyana prana takes over. So that is one more way of explaining the statement pranan praneshu juhvati. Like talking about the regular pranayama, Swami would say that when mastery over this particular technique is attained, as I mentioned, the inhalation and exhalation will happen automatically through one nostril and the other nostril without usage of the fingers. But then the other thing which happens with that practice is the inhalation and exhalation will activate the Ida and Pingala Nadi, and the retention of breath will activate the Sushumna Nadi. And this nadi system, the nerve point system, is, as I said, completely governed by the Vyana prana. And this also is why when Vyana exits where prana and apana meet, right? According to the Ayurveda, they say where prana and apana meet is where Vyana is. So these are all very advanced yogic techniques, and as I just want to give you a glimpse of how when we say that the Bhagavad Gita is not only a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, not only is it a pep talk that Krishna is giving, not only is it something that is speaking about Karma Yoga, but it is also a Yoga Shastra, it is a Brahma Shastra. It speaks about all of these yogic techniques in a very, very cryptic manner. And I think just to give you a snapshot of that, I'm making a reference to all of this. But the simple thing that for us we need to look at is that these are all different types of sadhanas that one performs, and Krishna is saying all of these sadhanas are different types of yajna. So Krishna is putting all these practices from simple sense control to advanced yogic techniques in one bracket, right? Yes, the intensity, if you look at it, of the sadhaka may be different. The way a yogi in the Himalayas has dedicated himself to sadhana cannot definitely be compared to the feeble efforts that you and I are making. The intensity and the focus is completely different, but they are all same in the fact that all of these help in preparing the mind by purifying it and making it ready for jnana. And that is the only context that is necessary for us when we are going through the shloka. But I'm just giving you a preview of the various meanings that this simple statement that is made in the shloka can have and does have. So that is how Krishna concludes this particular verse. He says, Sarve api yete yajna vidaha. All of these, without exception, are practitioners of yajna. And they are yajna shapita kalmashaha. Krishna uses this term to define all of these people that he has referred to. He calls them yajna shapita kalmashaha. Kalmasham means impurities. I think we have come across this word already once in the Gita series. So kalmasham means impurities. Kshapita means to be destroyed. Yajna kshapita kalmashaha means those whose impurities have been destroyed by this process of yajna. So Krishna is saying, if you're a karma yogi performing karma as yajna, if you're a sannyasi, if you're following different yogic practices, if you're leading a life of austerity, if you're leading a life of charity, if you're leading a life of seva, etc., 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 all of that, but you're doing all of this consciously for the purpose of antakarna shuddhi, or purification of the mind, then you are a yajna kshapita kalmashaha, the one who is trying to purify oneself through the process of yajna. No one of this is greater than the other. It is not that a mimamsaka who performs yajnas and a Vedantin, who is better between the two? There's no argument of that sort. It is not that what a grihastha does is greater than what a sannyasi does, or what a sannyasi does is greater than what a grihastha does. All of it are nothing but different pathways to attain jnana, and all of these prepare the mind by offering internal purity or antakarna shuddhi. So that is the whole idea of what is being conveyed in this entire section. I think we'll have enough time to go through the next verse too. The next two verses are summary of this, whatever Krishna has been telling in this so far. But we'll listen to verse number 31 and we'll discuss about that before we conclude this week's program.
Yajna Shishtamrita Bhujo Yanti Brahma Sanatanam Nayam Lokostya Yajnasya Kutonyah Kuru Sattama.
Those who eat the remnants of the sacrifice, which are like nectar, go to the eternal Brahman. This world is not for the man who does not perform sacrifice. How then can he have the other, O Arjuna? So Krishna had said in the third chapter that this world has been created so man can live, man can sustain himself, fulfill his needs, fulfill his desires too. In fact, that is one very beautiful point that Krishna made, that you can fulfill your desires through this world. It has been offered to you. But when he does it with an attitude of yajna, that whatever he uses is received as prasadam, after all his actions or karmas are offered as ahuti, then actions do not bind him, and that is the best way in which these great resources in the form of the world is being offered to you have to be used. And Krishna reiterates that point here. He says, Yajna Shishta Amrita Bhujaha. He is referring to all of these people with a title. He says, Yajna Shishta Amrita Bhujaha. Yajna Shishta means what is left over from a yajna. Amrita means nectar, right? So Yajna Shishta Amrita is the leftover from yajna, which is actually like nectar or amrita. Yajna shishta amrita bojaha means one who consumes the nectar, which is the prasadam from a yajna. Yanti brahma sanatanam. Such a person progresses towards the eternal Brahman. So that is what Krishna says here. Yajna shishta amrita bojaha yanti brahma sanatanam. A person who consumes whatever he consumes as the nectar which comes from a yajna, such a person proceeds towards the eternal Brahman. This particular phrase, yanti brahma sanatanam, is actually an indication that the reference is being made to a sadhaka. Krishna is speaking about a yogi, a karma yogi, or jnana yogi, whatever you can speak about. Because a jnani is not distinct from a Brahman. A jnani identifies with Brahman, right? There is no reaching Brahman in the context of a jnani. So a sadhaka who leads life in this manner slowly progresses and moves towards that state of immortality. As I said, I think somewhere around the 23rd verse, and when Krishna starts speaking about a yajna, at that point he is still speaking about a jnani. He does not speak about a yogi. Of course, the whatever he is saying, the details are useful for a karma yogi, but the reference is to a jnani, and that is the context in which the Brahmarpanam shloka comes. A jnani looks at what is being offered, who is receiving the offering, the act of offering, and everything as Brahman, right? But here he says, yanti brahma sanatanam, moves towards that eternal state of Brahman, which means now the reference is clearly to a sadhaka who is in a state which is distant from that Brahman state. So somebody who is a yajna shishta amrita bujaha, one who consumes whatever he consumes as a leftover from a yajna after performing this process of a yajna, such a person now starts moving towards Brahman. The next line is also quite significant, what Krishna says there. He says, ayajnasya, for one who doesn't have this yajna approach to life. Ayajnasya is one who does not live life in this manner. Ayam lokaha, this world, na asti, is not there. Or there is nothing this world can offer to a person. Who is such a person who does not look at everything as a yajna. Kutaha anyaha. How then can something be achieved in the other world? So Krishna says, even to lead a regular life of welfare, of health, of happiness in this world, you need this approach. Right? This is a very, very significant point that Krishna is making in summary. Yes, if you have higher goals in life, yes, if you have the goal of moksha or mukti in your life, you will have to, there is no question, you have to lead life in this manner. You will have to lead life as a yajna, as with an attitude of sacrifice. There is no doubt about that. But what Krishna is saying here is, a person who is a yajna, who does not live in this manner, who does not look at whatever he is doing or whatever she is doing as a yajna, and who's leading a very carefree life, who's leading an unregulated life, unconscious life, right? Unconscious in a different sense. We are not consciously doing, we're just going as the tide pulls us. We go after what attracts us, we run away from what we are scared of. An unregulated life, right? An undisciplined, indisciplined life. So when a person leads like that, such a person will not get the benefits of this world itself. Forget about the other world, forget about the attaining of moksha and all of that. You cannot get the true worth of this world itself. And when we are talking about the true worth of this world, we are not referring to material wealth. We are not referring to worldly authority. We are not referring to the pleasures that the world can give. What is it really worthy that this world can offer us, this plane of existence that we are in can offer us? It is happiness. It is peace, it is good health. As Swami would say, health is lost, something is lost, which means Swami gives a little bit of relevance at least to health. If money is lost, nothing is lost, Swami says. So these are the true wealth that this world and this life can offer us: happiness, peace, health. in love and satisfaction, the joy of being useful to others. Swami says these are the true wealths that you have in this particular frame of existence or plane of existence that we are in. And even to enjoy this, you need this approach of looking at everything as a yajna. And somebody who does not have that, he is not or she is not going to get the best of this world itself. Then where is the question of achieving something in the other world? So only when you lead a life of a yajna shishta amrita bhujaha, you can enjoy all that this world itself has to offer. So a greedy, a self-centered person does not get to enjoy this world itself. And I think that's a very, very significant and beautiful reiteration that Krishna is making here. If after going through all of this, we say, oh, this is too complicated, I don't want to lead this kind of a life, and let's keep moksha, we'll keep moksha in suspended animation, we'll come back the next time around and think about it. Krishna is saying here, forget about moksha, forget about reaching Brahman, forget about identifying with Brahman. Even to lead a proper, good, complete life in this lifetime itself, this kind of an attitude is required, this kind of having a regulated life. Swami would often say ahara, vihara, asana, pranayama, all of this, it plays a dual role. It helps us in this lifetime also, and it also helps us in taking us to the higher goals of life. So I think that's a very, very important point that Krishna is making in the context of this particular discussion, where he's referring to a karma yogi. We saw in the third chapter, in the second chapter, where Krishna said a karma yogi should have his focus on the higher goals of life. If for some reason we do not have that desire at this point in time, Swami says, that's all right. Even for a regular life, you should have this attitude. Do whatever actions that you perform as an offering to God. Accept whatever comes into your life as a prasadam, as the amritam which comes out of a yajna, right? Swami says that. And that is a way by which you get the best out of this lifetime itself. And it also leads to antakarna shuddhi or internal purity, which is a very important and necessary step in achieving jnana. So with that, dear listeners, I think we'll conclude this week's episode. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and I deeply thank all of you for joining me week after week. If you have anything to share, as I said, many of these things are interpretations. Some of these things, when Swami has explained in his discourses, I think I can speak of it with authority. But in cases where it is not clearly mentioned in Swami's discourses, or I have not come across that in Swami's discourses, many of these things, I'm sure my study is not absolutely thorough in that sense. So if some of you have come across some things and Swami has spoken about this and you would like to call our attention to that, please feel free to write to me. I would be happy to share it with all of us, all of our listeners, and benefit myself too. So feel free to write to me. You can write to listener@radiosai.org, or you can write to me personally at prem@radiosai.org, and be happy to receive all your comments and feedback. Today we don't have Bishu with us, so we'll not be having the Vahini Satsang, but as always, he's ensured that we have some fresh content to play for all of you. So in a short while from now, I'll be playing out a talk that Brother Bishu has given, which will be the last segment that we'll be having this Thursday. We'll come back to join all of you next Thursday as part of Thursday Live. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.